Side 9, Eon by Greg Baer. Continuing on page 344. Patricia blinked and then got out of bed, reaching for her robe. "Do you do this all the time?" "No," the robe replied. "Takes a lot of effort to get this far. I'd much rather be playing games in city memory, but my employers are handing out incredible advantages for the information. Luckily, I sent mine in just before the general release. Now everybody knows you're here."
"We've been told that already."
"Right," the rogue said. The lights in the bedroom came up. Patricia examined herself in the lavatory mirror and decided there wasn't much that could be done in a hurry. She looked exhausted, and her hair was tangled from restless sleep. "Anyway, answers," the rogue said. "More answers than questions asked. You're going to testify before the full Nexus in a couple of days. Nobody knows that yet but me and those who should. Then you're going to be included in the Last Gate ceremony. That's not its official name, but that's what it amounts to. You'll meet the Prime Gate Opener at the 1.3x9 segment and witness the opening. They may close it just after. Jarts coming down fast."
"What are jarts?"
"Fleas, the Nexus will tell you. Parasites, monstrously aggressive and not in the least cooperative. The Way was in place 1,000 years before it was finally connected to the Thistledown. Way time, of course, which wasn't congruent until the link-up. The Jarts entered through a test gate and took up residency before it was opened. They matured in the Way, and we had to fight them back. They know how to open gates, and they control between 2X9 and, we think, 4X9. But look, this is all in the memory, and I don't have much time. I have news about Olmi. You know about the Orthodox Naderites and the Geshels?"
"Yes," Patricia said.
"Well, they have two contingency plans, should the Jarts overpower us, which seems all too likely now. The Geshels want to mobilize the entire Axis city, grab the flaw and ride it at near-light speed over the Jart territories, and at the same time blow the Thistledown off the end of the Way."
"What? Why?"
"That could seal the Way, cauterize it, and eliminate the danger of the Thistledowns being reoccupied and having the entire Way controlled by Jarts. The other alternative is to guide the Thistledown to a habitable planet and simply abandon the Way, or close it down, eliminate it. The Axis city could escape by passing through the end of the Way, blowing off the Thistledown and going into orbit around the planet. That would take time, or would have until now. The Thistledown is in Earth orbit, an ideal situation for abandoning the Way. Everybody knows that. So the Orthodox Naderites, especially the Korzenovsky faction..."
"Who are they?" Patricia asked, all her muzziness vanishing at the rogue's mention of the familiar name.
"They're descended from the engineers who once supported the Way's designer, Konrad Korzenovsky. The Corps is a small conservative group, return-to-earthers, most of them. Geshels regarded them as candidates for inactive memory until now. The Naderites and Korzenovsky people are calling for reconsideration."
"They want to blow up the asteroid and take the Axis city into Earth-Moon orbit?"
"That's it. Now, my time's running out fast. I'm going to trigger all sorts of safeguards shortly, and I won't be able to visit you again. This is my last avenue. Olmi isn't what he seems. He's..." What happened next happened so fast Patricia could hardly follow it. The rogue's image wobbled violently, and something fizzled in the far wall. A jagged beam of red shot from the auxiliary pictor across the room and hit her slate on the nightstand. The rogue vanished. The bedroom lights dimmed. The furniture and walls were indistinct and gray.
"Brighter, please," she said.
"Many regrets," the room voice, now harsh and dissonant, replied. "Pictors in your quarters are malfunctioning. Please be patient. Repairs are in progress."
She sat on the edge of the bed. As her eyes adjusted, she realized that all detail had gone out of the room. She sat on a basic white bed form, surrounded by basic white furniture forms. The walls were blank. She picked up her slate to see if it had been damaged by the flash. On the screen, a crude line drawing of the rogue in his high-fashion togs appeared, followed by a string of numbers and then an end-of-string triangle. Beyond the triangle, in the next register, were three equations and a code equivalency. She integrated the two registers and performed a basic operation with the equations. Words appeared on the slate, flashing. Olmi knew Korzenovsky. knows him yet in Thistledown City. Olmi's quarters were in Axis Nader most of the time. He never kept a residence beyond 4 months, but he did stay in that section of the Axis city more often than not. He never decorated his quarters, relying on a minimum of elaboration to make the rooms livable. He seemed, in fact, to avoid as many as he could of the services most Axis citizens regarded as basic. Yet he was not an ascetic. He simply had no need for such accoutrements. He did not criticize those who did. He sat in the all-white living room, waiting for his trace to be completed. Olmi had patterned his tracer after the central mental programs of an old terrestrial species of dog known as a short-haired terrier, supplemented with several of his own partial personalities. It was a tough trace to elude, hardy and resourceful. It rarely failed him. By Axis City law, rogues in city memory were fair game. Citizens could not wipe the rogues they located, but they could corner them and call down an immediate inactivation. Olmi was not interested in inactivation. He simply wanted to maintain a steady trace on the rogue and to keep pressure on him, to heighten the sensation of illicit activity. The rogue was of very high quality. He had outlived dozens of duels, some extending across decades, which meant virtual millennia in city memory. He kept no name, not even adequate spoor. He had designed his active persona to be efficient, elusive, and only as egotistical as necessary to provide motivation for duels. The tracer had caught the rogue in Patricia's quarters, and Olmi had then commanded it to back off in such a way that the rogue would be led to believe it had escaped. Olmi was well acquainted with the personality of the average rogue. Most had been born during the final stages of city memory construction, a task that had taken over 500 years, beginning in Thistledown City before the creation of the Way. A number of citizens, generally young, had found ways to create loopholes and to circumvent the ultimate penalties being put into effect to deter crime, recycling of the citizen's body and inactivation of the stored personality. The most popular method was making an illegal duplicate personality, which would remain inactive in city memory. If the citizen received the ultimate penalty, the illegal duplicate would be activated, guaranteeing continuity. These rogues had been engaged in all manner of criminal activities, some of them resorting to acts of violence not seen in the Axis city since the expulsion of the Orthodox Naderites from Alexandria. Most were caught, tried, and sentenced, and the punishment carried out, releasing a virulently destructive group of personalities into city memory. As time passed, some of the rogues were convinced by Hexamon agents that the best way they could spend their time would be to engage in duels, searching out and eliminating other rogues. That solved much of the problem. Dueling caught on, and within a decade, half of the rogues had been eliminated by their own confreres. Many had survived, however, the smartest and most inventive, and therefore ultimately the most dangerous. In recent decades, one of the Nexus's most pressing problems was to make city memory completely safe for all citizens. The Nexus had made little progress. A stubborn residue of resistance remained, creating mischief and occasionally disrupting important functions. Hiring a rogue was always risky, Olmi knew. The patron could not expect complete loyalty. A rogue stayed loyal only so long as advantages and interest remained high. To that end, Olmi rewarded the rogue richly with access to several private data banks and made doubly sure that no one would ever discover who had done the hiring, especially the rogue himself. Chapter 53. The dark library brightened slowly, allowing his eyes to acclimate. Pavel Mirsky stood blinking on the far side of the plaza of seats and teardrop globes. His first impulse was to look for the damage done by Vilgorsky's spray of fire. There was none. All the globes were intact. Mirsky raised his hand to the side of his head and then to his nose and chin. No scars. In his head, a tiny, unobtrusive signal told him he was using part of his brain that did not originally belong to him. He walked back and forth, noticing a distinctly unpleasant sensation of inexperience behind his eyes. Then he circumnavigated the banks of chairs and approached the blank wall, still closed and featureless. Frowning, he called out, "Hello!" Nobody responded. "Hello! Where is everybody?" Perhaps he had been left alone.
The others may have exited the library after shooting him, but there had been the white curling mist, and he remembered the three officers with their heads jerked back, jaws slack.
"Pogodin," he called. "Pogodin, where are you?"
Again no answer. He crossed the dark corner of the library to the little doorway that led to the observation booth. The door was open. He climbed the stairs and entered the booth.
Pogodin stretched on three chairs, breathing steadily, apparently sleeping.
Mirsky shook his shoulder gently.
"Pogodin," he said, "time to leave now."
Pogodin's eyes opened, and he regarded Mirsky with surprise.
"They shot you," he said. "They took half your head away. I saw it."
"I've been dreaming," Mirsky said. "Very odd dreams.
Did you see what happened to Vyagorsky, to Bilezersky and Yazykov?"
"No," Pogodin said.
"Just mist all over me, itching. And now this."
His eyes widened and he sat up, lips quivering.
"I want to leave," he said.
"Good idea. Let's find out what happened." Mirsky preceded Pogodin down the stairs to the black wall.
"Open," he said.
The half-moon doorway irised open silently. Anyankovsky stood at parade rest with his back toward Mirsky and the door, holding his rifle by the barrel with the stock on the paving.
"Excuse me, Major," Mirsky said.
Anyankovsky tensed and swung around on one foot, lifting his rifle and fumbling it.
"Careful," Mirsky cautioned. "Comrade Colonel, I mean General."
"Where are the others?" Mirsky asked, looking at the troops in the quadrangle.
"Others?"
"The political officers."
"They haven't come out. Excuse me, General, but we must go to our camp right away. We must contact them by radio and..."
"How long have I been gone?"
9 days, General."
"Who's in charge?" Mirsky asked. Pogodin stepped up just behind him.
"Major Garabedian and Lieutenant Colonel Pletnyov, for the moment, sir."
"Then take me to them. What are the NATO troops doing here?"
"Sir..."
Anyankovsky seemed ready to faint.
"There has been a lot of tension. Nobody knew what happened in there. What did happen?"
"Good question," Mirsky said. "Maybe we'll find out later. For now, I'm fine. Pogodin is fine. And we need to go to the camp."
"In the fourth chamber?" "Yes, sir."
"Let's go. And why are our men stationed here?"
"Waiting for you, General."
"Then they'll come back with us."
"Yes, sir."
In the train, Mirsky closed his eyes and leaned his head against the wall. "I am dead," he thought. "I can feel it. Parts of me missing, replaced, fill dirt in gaping trenches. That means I'm a new person. I'm dead, come alive again. New, but stuck with the old responsibilities." He opened his eyes and looked at Anyankovsky. The major regarded him with an almost fearful expression, which he quickly wiped away and replaced with a wan smile. Chapter 54. "Let's sum it up, then," Lanier said. They had gathered again in Patricia's quarters to hear her story about the rogue and reach an agreement on their common behavior. "We're guests, but not exactly. We're protected, which means our condition bears some resemblance to being prisoners."
"Our data services are censored," Farley said.
"We can't go back to the stone," Heinemann said.
"And if what Patricia has learned is true, we're about to become celebrities," Carolson said.
"Did the rogue say whether anyone expected the stone to return to Earth?" Lanier asked.
"No," Patricia said, "but I don't think so. If I'm right, they thought it would simply continue through space, too small to be noticed, and never end up anywhere in particular, because of the snap when they opened the corridor."
"So what's our position on all this?" Lanier asked. "Larry? Lenore?" "What does it matter what we want? What can we do?" Heinemann asked, spreading his arms.
"Think, Larry," Carolson said, putting a hand on his knee. "We're celebrities. They can't just ignore our wishes."
"Oh, no," Heinemann said. "They can just brainwash us. They're not even human anymore, some of them."
"They're human," Patricia said. Just because they can choose what shape they want to be, or what talents or abilities they'll have, doesn't mean they're no longer our descendants.
Lord, Heinemann said, shaking his head, this is beyond me.
No, it isn't, Carolson insisted. If I can handle it, you can.
She pinched his knee. If we put forward a united front, we'll get more concessions, Lanier said. If we're celebrities, or even curiosities, we could have some control over how we're treated, and not so incidentally, how our people on the stone are treated.
So what are we going to demand? Carolson asked. First, we insist that our data services be uncensored, Patricia suggested.
I haven't even used mine, Heinemann said.
We make every attempt to get permission to communicate with the stone. Lanier looked around the room.
Are we agreed to that?
They were.
We make sure that we travel in a group. We should never be separated, he continued. If we are, we protest.
Hunger strike, Farley said.
Whatever works. It seems obvious to me that our hosts are not ogres, and it's not likely we'll be mistreated. Dazzled a bit, perhaps, subjected to all kinds of future shock, but we can handle that. We all survived our time on the stone, so we can survive this, right?
Right, Farley said, regarding Lanier with an expression of something more than respect for authority.
Patricia glanced between them and put on what Lanier thought of as her sharp, cheery look, a smile with an edge, her square eyes intense. Carolson inspected all three intently.
Olney's in the lounge, Patricia said. He has Ram Kikura with him. I told him to wait until we were finished, but they want to talk to us.
So, are we united? Lanier asked.
Of course, Heinemann said softly. Olney and Ram Kikura entered Patricia's quarters and sat in the middle of the group, legs crossed. Ram Kikura smiled happily. To Lanier, she looked hardly more than Patricia's age, though she had to be much older. Lanier presented their demands. To his surprise, Olney agreed to almost everything, excluding only communication with the Thistledown.
That I cannot grant you right now. Perhaps later. We can allow you uncensored access to data, but that will require some education, he said. Full access to data is very complicated, a great responsibility. There is potential for abuse. For a start, would you accept the help of a pedagogue? Ram Kikura could assign a ghost, a partial personality based on her own. This pedagogue will perform searches for you as well as instruct. Our younger citizens use them all the time.
It will let us research anything? Patricia asked.
That is a difficult request, Ram Kikura said. Not even a citizen has access to everything in city memory. There is much that could be dangerous for the untrained.
Like what? Heinemann asked.
Programs that alter personality, or merge different personalities, psyche enhancement, various high-level fictions and theoretical programs. You may wish to explore these later, but for now a pedagogue will protect you from inadvertently, let's say, getting in over your head.
Or under, Carolson said.
Are we still being kept pure? Patricia asked.
To a certain extent, Olney admitted. But the tests have been performed.
They have?
Heinemann betrayed his shock.
Yes, while you slept.
I think we should have been advised what was happening, Lanier said, frowning.
You were. Your sweet personas guided our inquiries, and we did nothing they did not agree with.
Jesus, Carolson said. What in the hell are sweet personas?
Ram Kikura raised her hands.
Perhaps now you see why your legal status is that of children, or at best adolescents. You are simply unprepared for full exposure to all the Axis City has to offer. Please don't be offended. I'm here to help whenever possible, not to hinder or frustrate you. I'm also here to protect, and I will do that over whatever objections you may have.
Is that what advocates do? Heinemann asked. I mean, are they lawyers or what?
An advocate is both a guide and a legal representative, Ram Kikura said. We advise on courses of action based on researches our assigned ghosts perform in city memory and elsewhere. We have many advantages, access to private memory collections, for example. While we cannot divulge the contents of those collections, we can act on what we learn within limits. Some advocates, myself included, offer what in your time might have been called psychological counseling.
Basically, Olney said,
Ser Ram Kikura will provide another layer of protection against abuse from higher authorities. Do you have any other questions?
Yes, Carlson said, looking to Lanier. He nodded, and she continued. What's going to happen to our people on the stone, in the Thistledown?
We don't know yet, Olmi said. That decision hasn't been made.
Will they be treated properly, Farley asked. Americans and others?
I can guarantee they won't be harmed, Olmi said.
Do you have any idea when we can communicate with them? Lanier asked.
Olmi tapped his index fingers together before his chest and said nothing.
Well?
As I said, that question has not been decided. There is no immediate answer.
We'd like to know as soon as you learn, Lanier said.
You will, Olmi assured them. You have been protected and isolated. That will change somewhat now that your presence is no longer secret. You recognize your potential popularity. There will be ceremonies and tours. You'll probably be quite worn out by the attention.
I'm sure, Lanier said dubiously.
Now, Ser Olmi, just between the seven of us, if you're just one person, as you seem to be, and there's nobody peering over your shoulder, what stake do you have in us?
Mr. Lanier, Olmi said, you know as well as I that now is not the time to be perfectly frank. Frustrating as it may be, you simply do not understand, and if I were to try to explain, I would only confuse you.
I will explain, eventually, but first you must experience our city, our cultures, since you are now free to use the data services.
Relatively free, Lanier said.
Yes, free with protections. You may wish to spend the next 24 hours boning up, if that's the right idiom.
Do we face any other restrictions?
Yes, Olmi said. You cannot leave these living areas, not until your schedule has been made up and the Nexus has arranged for your, let's call it a debut. And before that happens, we suggest you become fully informed about the Axis city and learn at least a little of the ways we live.
He looked from face to face, his eyebrows raised to solicit any more questions, but none were asked. Lanier clasped his hands behind his neck and leaned back on the couch. Ram Kikura programmed the pictures from where she stood.
There is now a pedagogue based on my personality, she said. You may use the data services from any of your apartments, and the pedagogue will help you. It would be best to begin with the city and way description. Agreed?
The seven of them watched in silence as the Axis city was projected before them in hypnotic detail. They seemed to approach the city from out of the north, swooping along very close to the singularity, the flaw, and passing through several dark shields. Their point of view then fell to very near the wall of the way, until they seemed to hover a few hundred meters over the flowing lanes of traffic. Heinemann twitched when he saw rushing tank-like cylinders conveyed along multiple tracks below them, each cylinder equipped with a circle of brilliant forward-facing searchlights on the nose and three bands of running lights along the side. In the distance, a 4-kilometer-wide gate terminal accepted thousands of the cylinders from all directions. A visual appendix briefly showed them the interior of the terminal, a maze of multi-level switching yards, cylinders being rerouted, guided into sheds to be loaded or unloaded, the contents being transferred to different containers for their trips into the gate. The gate itself was much wider than the ones they had encountered, a stepped hole at least 2 kilometers wide, resembling an open pit mine, but more regular, and much more crowded with machinery. The Axis city was awesome from any angle, but from near the surface of the way it was overwhelming. The picture highlighted the northernmost parts of the city and explained their functions. Then their point of view moved south. The farthest southern extension of the city was a broad Maltese cross, extended from 2 cubes mounted one behind the other in the flaw. The center of the cross accepted the flaw, which then extended through the cubes. Here was the machinery which powered, propelled, and guided the city along the singularity. The same effect that could move the city along the flaw and had propelled the tube rider also provided much of the city's energy. Generators within the cubes were spun by turbines whose blades intersected the singularity and were subjected to the spatial transform.
Where does the energy ultimately come from? Patricia asked herself. Did the question even have meaning?
Beyond the two cubes was a wine-glass-shaped buffer, the broad end placed flush against the first spinning cylinder, Axis Nader, where their quarters were located. Axis Nader was the oldest section of the city. After the final transfer of the Orthodox Naderites from the Thistledown, they had been moved into Axis Nader, which became a kind of Naderite ghetto. The then-expanding populations of Neomorphs had moved north to Central City and the other rotating cylinders, newer and therefore more desirable in terms of real estate. Axis Nader rotated to produce a centrifugal force at its outermost levels about equal to the force in the way. Its population was still largely Orthodox Naderites, which, it went without saying, were almost entirely homomorphic. Beyond Axis Nader was Central City. The geometry of Central City's architecture was dazzling by itself. Lanier's curiosity triggered a graphic breakdown of the shape, beginning with a cube. Each face of the cube supported a squat pyramid. The steps rotated slightly with respect to each other, creating a half spiral. The overall shape could fit within a sphere about 10 kilometers across and was rather like a Tower of Babel, as conceived by the 20th century artist M.C. Escher if he had collaborated with architect Paolo Soleri. In all respects, Central City was the showpiece of Axis City. The twisted pyramid motif seemed to be universal. It was also the shape of the gate terminals. Beyond Central City was Axis Euclid, which contained a mixed population of neomorphs and homomorphs of both Geshel and Naderite sympathies. Axis Thoreau and Axis Euclid counter-rotated to offset the rotation of Axis Nader, which was slightly larger than either of them. The projected point of view returned to the Maltese Cross at the southern end of the city. Within the center of the cross, they found themselves in a docking facility, witnessing the outfitting of a much larger, much more sophisticated version of their own destroyed tube rider. Called a flaw ship, the craft was about 100 meters long, shaped like an ocarina pinched in the middle. The two segments of the spindle were almost featureless, one shiny gray-black, the other blue-violet. Facts and figures accompanied the display. The flaw ship, one of a fleet of more than 100, could travel at 5,000 kilometers a second. It could disengage from the flaw to allow other traffic to pass, though Heinemann confessed he didn't see how this was done since the flaw passed right down the center of the ship, and it could also send out smaller craft for landing parties and reconnaissance. Near the surface of the way, the immense disks they had seen on their approach provided transportation for cargo and passengers on less extensive trips. The picted tour ended with a gold and silver armillary sphere whirling before them. "Ser Olmi," Lanier said. "Yes?" "Are we guests or prisoners?" "Neither, actually," Olmi said. "Depending on who you ask and how honestly they answer, you are assets or you are liabilities. Please remember that. We have 3 receptions planned," he said. "One before the Hexamon Nexus, the second on the Frant homeworld, Timbal, where we may be able to meet with the president, and the third at 1.3X9, where a new gate is to be opened." Lanier stood slowly and pinched the bridge of his nose. "All right," he said. "We've gone public, and now we're being used for purposes of propaganda. It'll take us years to become sophisticated here. Maybe we'll never make it, since we don't have implants. But at least you're showing us more than before. We're no longer unblemished specimens of pre-death Homo sapiens." He paused, uncertain where he was heading. "But you'll never be completely happy with my explanations," Olmi interrupted. "You sense, however much we tell you, there's a subtext you cannot understand. And you're right. You'll notice that I have never asked you to trust me. That would be more than I could reasonably expect. But for this once, it should be obvious that we can help each other enormously. You want to communicate with your fellows, and the Nexus must come to grips with your very presence and what that implies. In the next few days, you're going to learn more about the Way and our mission here, more than even the data pillar could tell you. I'll escort you, and Suliram Kikura and I will do everything in our power to plead your case, first because it is just, and then because I believe that what is in your best interest also serves the Nexus." Lanier looked at the other four, his gaze lingering on Farley, and then Patricia. Farley smiled encouragement. Patricia's expression was less clear.
You have our cooperation, within reason, for 7 more days, Lanier said. If it isn't obvious to me that our interests are being mutually served, and if we haven't been allowed to communicate with the Thistledown, the cooperation stops. I don't know how much of a threat that is, he said, taking a deep breath. For all I know, you can create computer-generated images of us and make them do whatever you want, or even manufacture look-alike androids. But that's our position. Agreed, Olmi said. 7 days. Olmi and Ram Kikura left them. Heinemann swung his head back and forth slowly, then looked at Lanier. Well? We keep on studying, Lanier said, and we bide our time. Hoffman stood before the small mirror in her cardboard condo, as she had come to call the room in the women's bungalow. She decided she didn't look too bad. She had been sleeping better the past few days. The suicide rate had declined. Her people, Hoffman always thought of them that way, soldiers and civilians, seemed to be accepting their fate, and plans were underway to re-outfit the shuttle and some of the Russian heavy lifters and see if a trek to the moon was possible. A few were even discussing an expedition to Earth, Gerhardt and Rimskaya leading that group. Rimskaya had recovered with remarkable speed from his lapse, as he referred to it. He had been acutely embarrassed and had finally requested, somewhat paradoxically, that people stop being so understanding. Be as hard on me as I would be on you, he had demanded. Hoffman had immediately put him in charge of logistics, an area she knew he would handle well. Always put a tough but very smart son of a bitch in front of the food and supply lockers. He would coordinate well with the Russians, and he would take that load from her back. In his spare time, what little there was of it, he could confer with Gerhardt on their Earth plans. Hoffman had her own unique ways of being hard on people. Rimskaya seemed to flourish under the new and extensive workload. Her only major worry, for now, was the fate of the Tube Rider expedition. With the return of Mirsky and the disappearance of the 3 political officers, the Russians were becoming more and more cooperative. There was the problem of a shortage of women. There had been 2 rapes and several near instances, but that was fewer than she had expected. Many soldiers, NATO and Russian, had donated small arms to the women. They had not had to use them yet. Hoffman had an appointment to meet with Mirsky in the 4th chamber in an hour. It would be their 2nd meeting since his return, and the agenda up for discussion was long, but not riddled with crises. With Beryl Wallace and 2 Marines, she rode the Zero train from the 1st chamber to the 4th, then transferred to a truck in the NATO compound. The Russian compound had split into 3 during Mirsky's absence. It now occupied a long stretch of shore and 2 offshore islands. 2 large rafts had been slung together out of logs, and boats were being constructed slowly and painstakingly. There were no facilities for processing lumber yet, though it seemed there might be in a couple of months, and the materials available to the boat builders were primitive. The spinward trip through the forest was pure pleasure for Hoffman. The Russian mainland compound was near the 90 train platform, about 40 kilometers from the NATO compound. Some of the most rugged terrain and deepest woods surrounded the Stoner-built road. There was even a gentle rain that beaded the truck windows. Wallace talked about the resumption of science in the 6th and 7th chambers. Hoffman listened and nodded, but found the subject somehow uninteresting. Wallace sensed this after a few minutes and allowed her to sink deeper into her reverie. The Russian mainland compound resembled an old western fort. Tall saplings had been stripped of branches and bark and erected to form a secondary wall of defense beyond a high rampart of dirt. Russian soldiers swung wide the gates at their approach and swung them shut behind. The first thing that caught Hoffman's eye was a gallows. It stood, unoccupied, she thanked God, in the center of a quadrangle cleared of all grass and foliage and demarcated by head-sized boulders. Other log buildings were under construction. The most ambitious was going to be 3 stories tall, designed along the lines of an old Russian country house. Soldiers motioned them to park the truck behind a long, narrow building made of split logs. Mirsky received them informally at a desk in the east end of the long building. There were no walls. Other work areas and sleeping slings were open for all to see. Hoffman and Wallace shook his hand, and he motioned for them to sit in the canvas chairs. The Marines stood outside, solemnly flanked by two Russian troopers. He offered them tea. "Part of our allotment from your commissary, I'm afraid," he said. "But it is good tea."
"You're making progress with the camp," Hoffman said.
"Let's speak English," Mirsky suggested. "I need to practice." He poured the dark amber tea into three lightweight plastic cups.
"Fine," Hoffman said.
"I can't take credit for the progress," Mirsky said. "You know, I was not here when most of this work was done."
"Everybody has been curious," Hoffman said.
"Oh, about what?"
Hoffman smiled and shook her head.
"Never mind," she said. "No, I insist." Mirsky's eyes widened. "What?"
"Your disappearance."
He looked between them. "I was dead," he said. "Then I was made well again. Does that answer your question?" Before she could reply, he said, "No, I wouldn't think so." "Well, then, I don't know. It's as much a mystery to me as to you."
"Well, whatever," Hoffman said, relaxing her smile. "We're glad you're back. There's a lot of work to be done."
First on the agenda was a discussion of the unloading of the heavy lifter carrying equipment and supplies. It had remained docked in the borehole since the death. The crew had been allowed to evacuate, but no agreement had yet been reached on disposition of the cargo. In a few minutes, Hoffman and Mirsky negotiated a satisfactory procedure. All armaments would be left in a locked chamber in the staging area, guarded by Russians and NATO personnel. Other materials would be delivered to the Russian fourth chamber compound. "We need material to barter as much as we need the supplies," Mirsky said. The status of the Russian science team was next. Hoffman maintained that team members who wished to remain with the NATO group should be allowed to do so. Mirsky thought in silence for a moment, then nodded. "I need no more people uncertain about my rule," he said, regarding them both with eyes wide and facial muscles taut. He blinked twice, rapidly. Hoffman glanced down at her notes.
"This is going even more smoothly than last time," she said.
Mirsky leaned toward her, elbows on his knees, hands clasped. "I am tired of disputes," he said. "I have the calm of a dead man, Miss Hoffman. I'm afraid I unsettle some of my comrades."
"You keep saying you were killed. That doesn't make sense, General."
"Perhaps not, but it is true. I do not remember everything, but I remember I was shot in the head. Pogodin tells me they..." He held up his hands. "You can deduce who killed me. Half my head." He waved his hand away from the right half of his skull. "Killed, and then I was brought back to life again. I am thankful I was unarmed, or I might be where Bilozersky, Vyogorsky, and Yazykov are even now."
"And where is that?"
"I'm not positive," Mirsky said. "In detention, perhaps. It seems Thistledown City still has the means to carry out its own law."
"I thought that might be what happened.
That means Thistledown City is still capable of making decisions and judgments and acting on them." "We must watch our behavior there, no?" Mirsky suggested. Hoffman nodded and returned to the agenda. One by one, within 45 minutes, all the items were covered, negotiated, and agreed to. "It's been a pleasure," Mirsky said, standing and offering her his hand. Hoffman shook it firmly, and he escorted them to the truck. "What about the gallows?" Wallace asked as they backtracked anti-spinward to the Zero compound. "What are we going to make of that?"
"No more Mr. Nice Guy," Hoffman suggested idly. "Maybe it's just a warning."
"He's spooky," Wallace said. Hoffman agreed.
"Very," she said.
Chapter 55. From their quarters in Axis Nader, the five were taken by Suliram Kikura and the Frant to the Flaw Passage, around which the cylindrical precinct rotated. Their transportation was an empty shaft, 3 kilometers long. Their fall was similar to a ride in the apartment building elevator in Thistledown City, and therefore, mercifully, not too unexpected. Carlson enjoyed it the least of them. She had a distinct fear of precipices, not of heights per se, but of edges. She managed, however, with both Lanier's and Ram Kikura's encouragement.
I'm not a goddamned old woman, she said resentfully as they fell. The floor passage was a half-kilometer-wide pipe through the Axis city, with the singularity at its center. Hundreds of thousands of citizens lined the walls and floated in clutching, roiling, yet very coordinated clusters along their path. Rankikura and the Frant conferred with the passage engineer, a female homorph who, like Olmi, was also self-contained and lacked nostrils. The five were then introduced to the first of many city officials, the minister of Axis Nader, a gray-haired, distinguished, and hale-looking Orthodox Naderite who flew a Japanese rising sun over his left shoulder. He seemed to have not an ounce of Oriental blood, but then his form could have been artificial, probably was, and no one had time or much inclination to inquire. "You may call me Mayor, if you like," he said in perfect English and Chinese. These languages were now the rage of the four precincts, extending even beyond those who claimed specific ancestry. On the floor was a beetle-like black maintenance vehicle, not dissimilar to the one that had dismantled the tube rider. It was larger, however, equipped with a wide and well-appointed cabin, liberally decorated with rare and genuine red bunting. Pictures projected very convincing fireworks around the vehicle and the floor as Rankikura, the mayor, and the Frant stood aside, allowing them to enter first. They took seats in a half-circle behind the controls and were gently clamped in by something they could not see. The mayor took the controls, a Y-shaped black pillar with receptacles for the fingers of two hands, and the hatch irised shut silently. They moved down the floor, preceded by a faint pulse of red. Fireworks still blossomed on all sides, sometimes harmlessly intersecting parts of the crowd. "It's not enough just to see you on the pictures," Rankikura said. "People haven't changed much. I guess that maybe a third of those out there are ghosts, pictured themselves with monitors at the center of their images. See and be seen." "Where's Alice?" Heinemann grumbled.
"Alice who?" Rankikura asked.
"Just Alice," Heinemann said. "I can't help feeling we're in Wonderland." "Are we missing someone?" the mayor asked, turning his head and appearing concerned. "No," the Frant said, making its tooth-grinding noise. The journey took a half hour, covering 15 kilometers from the vicinity of Axis Nader to the central city. Here the crowds were even more dense and more disorderly. Individuals, neomorphs predominating, tried to block the slow progress of the maintenance vehicle and were gently brushed aside by the uncurling sheets of traction fields rippling ahead of the craft. Patricia sat patiently, saying little, occasionally stealing a glance at Lanier. Lanier's face wore a constant, half-puzzled frown. He lifted his lip slightly at the appearance of some of the neomorphs, elongated snake-like curls, shiny as chrome, fish, birds, and radiolarian spheres like the silicate shells of plankton, varieties of human shape that went beyond the basic description of homorph. Farley absorbed it all with gape-jawed fascination.
"I'll bet I look like a rude," she said at one point, then glanced at her companions, realizing nobody understood her. "What's the word I'm looking for?" she asked Lanier.
"I haven't the faintest idea," he replied, grinning affectionately. She put her hand on his. Patricia withdrew a little into her seat.
"So, what is this?" she asked herself. "A little jealousy? Being unfaithful to Paul? Why should Gary pay any attention to you at all? He came to find you, out of a sense of duty."
She shut off that area of inquiry, seeing no need to invade a territory of great pain and uncertainty and guilt. They left the maintenance vehicle, and the mayor of Axis Nader, behind, escorted now by the neomorph minister of Central City and Senator Prescient Oryu. Olmi greeted them at the broad circular entrance to the Hexamon Nexus chamber. Within the chamber there was confusion on all sides. Homorphs, neomorphs, some with American flags picked over their shoulders, and at the center, near the podium, two wide and vibrantly living images of the flags of the Republic of China and the United States. Cheers and music, boisterous and welcoming. Heinemann blinked, and Carlson took his arm as they were pushed along a traction field by Olmi and Rankikura. Prescient Oryu, as beautiful and graceful as any woman Lanier had ever seen, took his arm and Patricia's, and the Minister of Central City entered beside Farthing. Lanier saw several senators, or were they corp reps, wearing the Soviet hammer and sickle, and then they were in the center of the Nexus chamber. The senators and corp reps became quiet, and all displays faded. Director Hulane Ram Seja came to the podium and told the Nexus that their guests would soon be going to the Frant Gate to see the workings of commerce in the way, and after that they would be taken by Senator Prishin Oryu to meet with her father, who even now presided over the preliminaries to a gate opening at 1.3x9. Lanier had been elected spokesperson for the group. Suliram Kikura had suggested, against Olmi's mild objections, that he might use this opportunity to state his case. He moved unsteadily along a traction field to the podium and received the armillary bands of light. He looked to all sides and behind before starting. "It's not an easy thing, talking to one's descendants," he said. "Though I never had children, so I doubt if any of you are even remotely related to me. And of course there's the matter of different universes. Discussing these things makes me feel like a Stone Age tribesman seeing his first airplane, or spaceship. We are completely out of our element, and while we have been welcomed here, we cannot call this place home." He caught Patricia's eye, and her brief expression between fear and expectation. "Of what?" "But the one place we can call home is now in ruins. This is our tragedy, our mutual tragedy. For you, the history of the death is remote, but for us it is immediate and very real. We still suffer from our memories, our experiences, and we will grieve for years to come, probably for the rest of our lives." What he needed to say came clear to him then, as if he had been thinking about it for days, and perhaps he had, but not consciously. "Earth is our home, your cradle, as well as my own. It is now a place of death and misery, and it is beyond the power of my friends and colleagues to remedy that. But it is not beyond your power. If you would celebrate us, and celebrate our unlikely presence in this chamber, then would it not be appropriate to help us? Earth needs your help, desperately. Perhaps we can rewrite history and correct it. Let us go home together," he said, feeling his throat catch. In the first ring of seats, Olmi listened and nodded only once. Just beyond, in the second ring, Oligan Toller, the president's advocate and representative in this session, locked the fingers of his two hands in his lap, his face impassive. "Let us go home," Lanier repeated. "Your ancestors need you." Chapter 56. Pletnyov blew out his breath and wiped his red face with a scrap of towel, dropping the axe into a tree stump. A few meters away, a stack of notched logs waited assembly into a cabin. Pletnyov had also made a trough for mixing mud to daub into the cracks between the logs and cleared a site in the woods near the beach. Beside him, Garabedian and Anyankovsky stood with arms crossed, faces intently surveying the ground. "Are you saying," Pletnyov began, after blowing out again, "that he has changed so much we can no longer rely on him?" "He isn't concentrating on his command," Anyankovsky said. "He holds us back." "Holds you back from doing what?" "For one thing," Anyankovsky continued, "he treats Vilgorsky's followers as if they were merely errant children and not dangerous subversives." "Well, perhaps that's wise. There are too few of us to purge willy-nilly." "That is not the only problem," Anyankovsky said. "He frequently leaves the compound, takes the train and a truck to the library, and just sits there, looking confused. We think his brain is addled." Pletnyov looked to Garabedian. "What do you think, Comrade Major?" "He is not the same man," Garabedian said. "He himself admits it. And he keeps claiming he is dead, resurrected. It isn't appropriate." "Is he still General Pavel Mirsky?" "Why ask that? Ask if he is a good leader," Anyankovsky said. "Any of us could do better." "He's been negotiating with the Americans. Has he negotiated badly?" Pletnyov asked. "No," Garabedian said. "Smoothly, if anything." then I don't understand what we have to complain about. He'll return to normal. He's had a traumatic experience, and a mysterious one. We can't expect it not to change him some.
Anyankovsky frowned and shook his head. I disagree that he's negotiated well for us. He's made many concessions he shouldn't have.
And he's gained concessions very useful to us, Pletnyov said.
I know. Because of the agreements, we may be able to move into the cities soon.
He is no longer in his right mind, Anyankovsky said heatedly. He talks about not being the same person. He does not have the touch a commanding general should have.
Pletnyov looked between the two majors and then glanced up at the plasma tube, squinting.
What would Virgorsky and Yazykov and Bilizersky have done for us?
Nothing. Made things worse. Killed all three of us, more than likely.
I say, do not trade the devil you know for the devil you don't. Mirsky is a mild sort of devil.
He's a lamb, not a devil, Garabedian said dubiously. I regard him as a friend, but...
Pletnyov raised his eyebrows in query.
Well, in a crisis, I do not know how he would behave.
I think the crises are over, Pletnyov said. Now forget this talk. Go. Do not rock the boat. Let me build my cabin in peace.
Garabedian nodded, stuck his hands in his pockets, and turned to walk away. Anyankovsky stayed for a moment, watching Pletnyov trim a notch in a log.
We were thinking of making you our leader, Anyankovsky said quietly. We would not harm General Mirsky.
I do not accept, Pletnyov said without looking up.
What if he goes completely crazy?
He won't, Pletnyov said.
Where are you? Mirsky shouted for the dozenth time.
He stood in the middle of the array of library seats and data pillars, fists raised in the air. His cheeks were red and wet, and his neck was ribbed with anger and frustration.
Are you dead, like me? Did they execute you?
Still no answer.
You murdered me!
He clenched his jaw and struggled to control his breathing. He knew if he tried to say anything more, the words would come out in mangled fragments. The little signal in his mind, a brief explanatory warning. You are now using material not native to your personality, was about to drive him over the edge. So much of what he thought and did was punctuated by this message. He had explored those boundaries thoroughly, lying in his sling at night, trying to sleep, realizing he did not need to sleep. He had the sensation that much of what he remembered about his life consisted of logical reconstructions. The entire left side of his body felt fresh and new, had a different odor, as it were. He realized it wasn't the body that was new, but the corresponding section of his head. The first few days, Mirsky had thought all might go well. He believed he could become used to his status as a Lazarus. He made it seem like a joke, that he was back from the dead. This to gently discredit Pogodin's testimony that Virgorsky had blown Mirsky's brains out, but the joke had not worked. To the soldiers who had stood guard outside the library, it had seemed as tightly sealed and oppressive as a tomb. And what did you find in a tomb? His joke had then become a grim evaluation of reality. Nobody dared flout his rule now. He was a ghost, not the freshly promoted colonel, suddenly made lieutenant general. Not Pavel Mirsky, but a stranger from the depths of the third chamber city. Superstition, an incredible force among soldiers. And so, after a week of rule, of struggling to be what his past demanded he be, he had returned to the library. He had been afraid to come back until now, worried that the three political officers would be there to greet him, shoot him all over again. Superstition. He had waited for those inside to leave. First the Chinese man and woman, and then a single Russian, Corporal Rozhensky. Only when the library was empty had he entered. And he had shouted himself hoarse. He sat in a chair, hand fumbling at the data pillar controls, lifting the lid and dropping it. Finally, he inserted his fingertips into the five hollows.
Law, he demanded. Law in a deserted city.
The library asked more questions, narrowing his search to a manageable subject. Murder, he said. The material was rich and detailed.
Murder was an offense punishable by psychological evaluation and retailoring of the personality, if such was called for. What if there is nobody to carry out the punishment? It is not punishment, the research voice said. It is redemption, a refitting for society. What if there's no law, no police, no judges, or courts, or psychologists? Suspects can be detained for 19 days. If that time passes and no judgment is made, or charges specified, suspects are released to the custody of a reintegration counseling clinic. And if there's no clinic, suspects are released on their own recognizance. Where will they be released? Unless otherwise requested, at the scene of their incarceration. Where are they taken after capture? If they are captured in a structure of adequate size for an emergency medical facility, he saw a portion of the library behind a seamless door in the north wall used as an example, two small equipment-packed rooms. Then they are held under sedation until authorities retrieve them, or 19 days have passed. Medical workers serve as police units in emergency. He had two more days. Mirsky returned to the fourth chamber and made a pretense of being the commander for a few hours. He met with Hoffman and Rimskaya to continue discussions about opening the second and third chamber city spaces to settlers. He then sneaked away, picked up an AKV, and returned to the third chamber. Five people were in the library, Rodzinski again, and four NATO people, one of them a United States Marine. Mirsky patiently waited for them to go and entered the library with rifle in hand. He had given the political officers one chance. If they were released, they would only come for him again. He would stay in the library for the next 2 days, waiting patiently. The library remained deserted for several hours. In that time, he realized that his plan was useless. The library would not stay deserted for long. He had to carry out his executions, murders, in secret, or they would be worse than useless. Unless he destroyed the three political officers even more thoroughly than they had destroyed him, they would be resurrected, and he would be incarcerated for 19 days, and it would all begin again, a cycle of insanity and violence beyond the dreams even of Gogol. He walked to the walls behind which the three political officers waited, unconscious, and lowered the rifle to the floor at the northern edge of the array of seats, blinking rapidly. "I'm not the same person you killed," he said. "Why should I take revenge?" Even if he felt that he was the same person, this could be an excuse. He could do what he realized he had wanted to do for years. Perhaps the clarity had been brought on by the destruction of some irrational section of his thinking, releasing another impulse, truer and cleaner. Mirsky had always wanted the stars, but not at the price of his soul. And working within a Soviet system, even one such as he would have tried to establish, would always mean working against people like Bilozerski, Yazykov, and Vyogorsky. Their faces kept reappearing throughout Russian history, the vicious lackeys and the capable but cruel and slightly askew leader. He would break from the cycle. He had the chance now. His homeland was gone. His duty was over. He had already died for his men once. Perhaps if Major General Sosnitsky had survived. But then if the Major General were still alive, Mirsky wouldn't be in this position. Sosnitsky would be. He left the library and rode the train to the fourth chamber fort. There he gathered supplies into a truck, nobody questioning his intentions, not even Pletnyov, who regarded him from some meters away with a look of mild puzzlement. "They'll be glad to be rid of me," Mirsky thought. "They can get on with their intrigues and cruelties. The political triumvirate will return to take their rightful places. I've been an impediment all along." His last duty was to write a message for Garabedian. "Viktor, the three political officers will return. They will be in the third chamber library sometime within the next 40 hours. Accept them as your leaders if you wish. I will no longer impede them. Pavel." He left the message in an envelope in Garabedian's tent. Mirsky drove the truck into the woods, heading for the as yet unexplored 180 point. There he could be alone, perhaps build a raft, and pole across a shallow lake to a tree-covered island, or just explore the thick woods visible 50 kilometers directly overhead. And he would decide what to do next. He did not think he would return. Chapter 57. The floorship's interior, crowded with privileged citizens and dignitaries, was even more free-form than Olmi's craft. The surfaces varied from oyster pearl to abalone gray, and there seemed to be no edge or corner, only one spacious long cabin wrapped around the 3-meter-wide floor passage and propulsion machinery. People of a bewildering variety of body styles tracted from point to point in the cabin, exchanging picks or conversing in English or Chinese. Some sipped drinks from free-floating charged globules of fluid, which somehow managed to avoid passers-by with both grace and anticipatory intelligence. Lanier had barely gotten the hang of maneuvering with the traction fields. Farley seemed more adept, a natural gymnast, which caused him some chagrin. He applied himself more diligently to learning the skill. "This is lovely," she confessed, spinning slowly next to him, then reaching out and breaking against the gently glowing violet sheet of a field. Heinemann and Carlson helped each other along between the homomorphs and neomorphs, smiling stiffly and nodding, hoping that, as Olmi had told them, they would find it almost impossible to do something socially unacceptable. Anything they did, any mistake they made, would be considered charming. They were, after all, quaint. Patricia tried to keep to herself, clutching her bag containing slate, processor, and multimeter. She was not in the least successful at being inconspicuous. Suliram Kikura attracted toward Patricia and intercepted the rapid pictings of a man whose skin had the sheen of black hematite. The man apologized in a few simple picts for his assumption that Patricia knew the highest degrees of graphic speak. Then, in moderately accomplished English, no doubt picked up in a quick gloss a few minutes before boarding, he launched into a complicated discussion of early terrestrial economics. Kikura had wandered off to smooth over another complication. Lanier was being determinedly, if slowly, pushed into a broad dimple by two lean and striking women. The women were dressed in full-length leotards with long, alternately stiff and supple fantails of fabric stretched between their legs and under their arms. They resembled fancy goldfish. There was little he or Farley could do to discourage them. Patricia listened to the man's discourse for several minutes before saying, "I'm pretty ignorant about that. My specialty is physics." The man stared at her, and she could almost hear him switching over to a recently programmed portion of his implant. "Yes, that's fascinating. So much of physics was in ferment in your time." Olmi moved in quickly and picked at something Patricia did not understand. The man moved away resentfully, a thin circle of red around his face. "Perhaps this wasn't such a good idea," Olmi said, escorting her to where the Frant was engaged in conversation with two neomorphs, one a Radiolarian, the other recognizable as the director of the Nexus, Hulain Ram Seja. "I suppose we have to get used to it," Patricia said. "Why get used to it?" she asked herself. She didn't plan on staying forever. "Sir Ram Seja," the Frant said, turning toward her, "here is our first guest." The Frant's wide-extended eyes seemed to naturally convey humor and good spirits. Though she found the word guest euphemistic at best, she did not resent the Frant's using it. "I've been looking forward to a chance to talk with you, someplace out of chambers," Ram Seja said, "though this hardly seems the best time." Patricia focused on his face, projected at mid-level on the sphere that was his body. She had a distinct impression she was on a ride in Disneyland, seeing something extraordinary with a perfectly mundane explanation. She didn't answer for some time, and then snapped herself out of her reverie, saying, "Yes, certainly."
"You'll enjoy Timbal, our world," the Frant said. "We've been long-time clients of the Hexamon. It's a very tame gate, long established."
"We'll go there first," Ram Seja said. "A journey of 4 hours to the Frant Gate at 4X6, and then a leisurely 2-day rest stop. We're hoping the President can break away from his conference to meet us."
4X6. 4 million kilometers down the corridor. Nearly a hop, skip, and jump, she thought. And for every 1,000 kilometers, an advance of 1 year in time. For every fraction of a millimeter, entry into an alternate universe. How much closer to home.
I look forward to meeting it, him, and to visiting Timbal, she said, acquiescing to the spirit of the occasion.
We're requested at the bow, Lanier said, brushing by with Farley. Heinemann and Carrollson were already on their way. The crowds parted before them. She had never seen so many smiling faces or felt so much interest in her person. She hated it. She wanted to run and hide. Feeling through her jumpsuit for the letter from Paul, finding it and pressing it, she followed the Frant and Olmey toward the bow of the floorship. Senator Oyu was there with three Naderite homorphs from Axis Thoreau, all historians. They smiled and made room for the five. The floorship captain, a neomorph with a masculine human trunk and a serpentine body from the waist down, fully 3 meters in length, joined them last. The honor for starting our short journey goes to the first guest to arrive at the Axis city, the captain said. Patricia took his hand and tracked it into position at the bow, near the floor passage. Miss Vasquez, would you like to do the honors? Simply ask the floorship to begin.
Let's go, Patricia said softly.
A sharp-edged circle, about 5 meters in diameter, cleared to one side of the floor passage, offering them a view of the way. They seemed to float high above the lanes of traffic and the gate terminals. The ineffably glistening line of the singularity glowed hot pink just below the bow. For the moment, there was no sensation of motion. Patricia turned to look back at Olmey, Lanier, and Farley. Lanier smiled at her. She smiled back. Despite everything, this was kind of exciting. She felt like an indulged and pampered child visiting a party of very peculiar adults.
We're the larvae. They are the butterflies, she thought.
Within a half hour, the floorship was moving so rapidly, just over 104 kilometers per second, that the walls of the way became a slick blur of black and gold. They had already traveled some 94,000 kilometers and were still accelerating. Ahead, the floor pulsed deep red. Patricia felt Farley's hand on her shoulder.
It's amazing how much this is like a party on Earth, Farley said. Not in Hopei, but in Los Angeles or Tokyo. I went through Tokyo to get to Los Angeles, and then on to Florida. There were quite a few receptions. The embassy party.
She shook her head and grinned.
Where the hell... What the hell are we, Patricia? I am very confused. They're people, just like us, Patricia said. I just don't... Can't always believe what's happening. Inside, I go back to when I was a little girl in Hopei, listening to my father teach. I escape.
Bringing Ramon, Tiempos de los Angeles, to read.
All parties get boring after a while. I'd rather be working, Patricia said, but that wouldn't be sociable. Olmey wants us to be sociable.
Suli Ramkikura approached them, looking concerned.
Has anybody offended you, she asked, or made improper offers?
No, Farley said. Patricia and I are just watching.
Of course, you're getting tired. Even Olmey forgets these necessities, sleep and rest.
I'm not tired, Patricia said. I'm very alert, in fact.
I as well, Farley agreed. Perhaps dazed is a better word.
You may seclude yourselves any time you wish, Ramkikura said.
We'll just stay in the bow and watch, Patricia said.
She floated with legs crossed in a lotus, and Farley did likewise.
We're fine, Farley said to the advocate. We'll rejoin everybody shortly.
Ramkikura tracked it aft to a group of neomorphs challenging each other with complex puzzle picts.
It's not a bad place to be, Farley offered after a few minutes of silence. These people aren't cruel.
Oh, no, Patricia said, shaking her head. Olmey is helpful, and I like Kikura.
Before we left, she was talking to Gary and me about our rights in selling historical information, or exchanging for advantage, she called it. Apparently we can access all sorts of valuable private data banks for what we have in our memories.
So I've heard, Patricia said. After an hour, Patricia, Heinemann, and Carrollson secluded themselves at the rear of the cabin. The Frant fended off the curious as they napped. Lanier and Farley were too wired to relax. They remained at the bow, watching the corridor race by. At the midpoint of their journey, after accelerating at just under 6 G's, the floorship was traveling some 416 kilometers per second. It then began to decelerate.
In another 2 hours, the floor ship had slowed to what seemed a crawl, only a few dozen kilometers an hour. Below, many of the broad silver-gray disks flew majestically above the lanes. 4 large twisted pyramid structures were discernible in the distance, the terminals covering the 4 gates to Timbal. 2 homorphs joined them, slightly more radical models of Olmi's ilk, self-contained and largely artificial. They were dressed in blue and white bodysuits that ballooned dramatically around the calves and forearms. One was female, though her hair was cut much like Olmi's, and the other was indeterminate. They smiled at Patricia and Farley and exchanged simple picts. Patricia touched her torque and replied. Farley flubbed her answer and made them laugh good-naturedly. The indeterminate one stepped forward, a Chinese flag suddenly picked above the left shoulder. "We have not met," it began. "I am Sama Ula Riksor, special assistant to the president. My ancestors were Chinese. We have been discussing morphology of those times. Miss Farley, you are rare, are you not? You are Chinese, yet you have Caucasian features. Is it that you have had what they called cosmetic surgery available even then?" "No," Farley said with some embarrassment. "I was born in China," she said, "but my parents were Caucasian." Patricia tracked it away from the stern, toward Lanier, Carlson, and Heinemann. Ram Kikura glided up to them and indicated they would be leaving the flawship soon. A VIP disk shuttle was already leaving the gate terminal to take them aboard. Heinemann was questioning Olmi about the identity of the Frant that had accompanied them, suspicious that it might have changed places with one of the 9 other Frants riding with them. "It looks different. Are you sure it's the same Frant?" "They all look alike when they're mature," Olmi said. "Why does it matter?" "I just want to know where I stand with somebody," Heinemann responded, reddening. "It's really not important," Olmi said. "Once they've homogenized and passed current memory to each other, one can take up where the other leaves off." Heinemann wasn't convinced, but he decided it wasn't worth pursuing. The VIP transportation disk was as wide as the floor ship was long. It ascended to within 30 meters of the axis, surface crawling with glowing sheets of charge picked up in the plasma field. The glow slipped away from the disk's upper surface like phosphorescent sea foam, and a circular opening appeared in the center. The flagship's hatches opened then, and the guests leaped out through the connecting fields in orderly pairs and triplets, hanging onto each other, tracting to the opening in the disk. Olmi took hold of Farley and Lanier held Patricia. Ram Kikura took Carolson's and Heinemann's hands. Together they flew with the rest of the group. The disk was little more than an enlarged version of the cupolas that had covered the gates just beyond the 7th chamber. Except for a webwork of glowing lines, it had no visible lower half, and to Heinemann's consternation, no platform or support to rest on. The party simply floated in the space immediately beneath, suspended in an invisible and all-enveloping traction field, which was in turn shot through with smaller visible fields. All that separated them from the vacuum, all that lay between them and the walls of the way, 25 kilometers below, was a barrier of subtle energies. Lanier saw several homorph and many more neomorph pilots and workers at the edges of the disk, segregated from the entourage. He watched a spindle-shaped neomorph weaving its way through purple traction sheets, followed by boxes from another section of the floor ship. On the opposite side, the 8 Frants also waited to disembark. Their own Frant had returned to its fellows and had already homogenized with them, rendering Heinemann's question academic. Lanier reached out for a tenuous purple traction line and twisted around to look at Heinemann. "How are you feeling?" he asked. "Lousy," Heinemann said. "He's a sissy," Carolson said, a little pale herself. "You should love this," Lanier chided him. "You've always been in love with machinery." "Yeah, machines," Heinemann growled. "Show me any machines. Everything works without moving parts. It's unnatural." The disk began its descent as they spoke. The clusters of passengers excitedly exchanged picks. Patricia floated with arms and legs spread, one hand grasping the same traction line as Lanier. She stared down at the terminal, watching the disks enter and exit ports near the base from 4 directions. Many more disks waited in stacks like so many pancakes, or fanned out in spirals within a holding column. The disc descended slowly, giving them plenty of time to inspect the wall traffic around the terminal. Most of the lanes were filled with the cylindrical container vehicles of many diverse shapes, spheres, eggs, pyramids, and some of a blobby appearance, composed of many complex curves. Lanier tried to make sense out of it all, using what the data pillar had taught them, but couldn't. There was apparent order, but no easily discerned purpose. Patricia tracked it in his direction. "Do you understand all that we're seeing?" he asked her. She shook her head. "Not all." Ram Kikura broke from a cluster of brightly dressed homorphs and came their way. "We'll pass through the gate in just a few minutes," she said. "You must know, if Olmi and the Nexus allow it, that I can make you very wealthy people." "Wealth still means that much?" Carlson asked dubiously. "Information does," Ram Kikura replied, "and I've already picked it with 4 or 5 powerful information distributors."
"Send us on tour like circus freaks," Heinemann grumbled.
"Oh, give me some credit, Larry," Ram Kikura said, touching his shoulder. "You won't be abused. I wouldn't stand for it. And even if I turned out to be, what did you call them, a shyster, Olmi would protect you. You know that."
"Do we?" Heinemann undertoned as she departed.
"Don't be a grouch," Carlson scolded.
"I'm being on my guard," Heinemann said testily. "When in Rome, watch out for public restrooms."
Lanier laughed, then shook his head. "Hell, I don't even know what he means," he confided to Patricia, "but I admire his caution."
The disk was now level with a broad, low port in the eastern side of the terminal. The surface of the building was coated by a material resembling opalescent milk glass, with bands of brassy orange metal spaced at seemingly random intervals on the horizontal planes.
"It's beautiful," Farley said. Patricia agreed and then felt her eyes grow warm and moist. She couldn't be sure why. Her throat clutched, and she wiped her cheeks as drops broke free.
"What's wrong?" Lanier said, edging closer to her.
"It is beautiful," she said, stifling a sob. Involuntarily, Lanier felt his own eyes moistening.
"We can't forget them, can we?" he asked. "Wherever we go, whatever we see, they're with us. All 4 billion of them."
She nodded rapidly. Olmi came up behind them and held an archaic and unexpected handkerchief over her shoulder. She took it, surprised, and thanked him.
"If you keep this up," he warned in a whisper, "you might be surrounded in a few minutes. We are not used to seeing people cry."
"Jesus," Carlson said.
"Don't judge us on that basis," Olmi said. "Our people feel as strongly, but we differ in how we express ourselves."
"I'm fine," Patricia said, dabbing ineffectually at her eyes. "You carried this just in case we..."
Olmi smiled.
"For emergencies."
Lanier took the handkerchief and finished wiping her face for her, then waved the cloth through the air to catch a few stray drops.
"Thank you," he said, returning it to Olmi.
"Not at all."
They entered the terminal. Within the hollow structure, beams of light outlined paths for vehicles to take. In the center, still perhaps a kilometer below them, was the gate itself, a vast, smooth-lipped hole leading into a featureless blueness.
"This is our second biggest gate, 5 kilometers in diameter," Olmi said. "The largest is 7 kilometers wide and leads to the Talcid world at 1.3x7.
"We're going down through this one?" Heinemann asked. The disk was already resuming its descent.
"Yes, there's no danger."
"Except to my mental health," Heinemann said.
"Gary, I wish I'd been a house painter."
They were directly over the gate now, but no detail was visible beyond the blueness. 5 smaller disks moved in a squadron below, clearing a path for them. At the rim of the gate, hundreds of cylinders and other vehicles cascaded from the lanes in majestic, controlled fall. Light guidelines rearranged to surround their disk in a column. When they had descended to a point where they were approximately level with the edge of the gate, Lanier suddenly made out details in the bottom, directly beneath. The Frant world was actually visible in the blueness, as if distorted in an old painting on a cylinder that could only be seen when placed on a circular mirror. He could make out oceans, distant mountains black against an ultramarine sky, the elongated and brilliant orb of a sun.
Jesus, Carolson said again. Look at it.
I wish I wasn't, Heinemann said. Do you think Olmi has any Dramamine?
The floating clusters of homomorphs and neomorphs picted bright circles and bursts of color in appreciation. The disk vibrated, and the landscape slid smoothly into proper perspective. The guiding column of light beams vanished, and they completed their gate passage, suddenly sweeping low over a dazzling white surface. Lanier, Carolson, and Patricia tracked to a lower point of the disk, near the boundary of the webwork lines of force, so that they could see the horizon of the Frant world. To each side, lines of cylinders and other vehicles were spaced between hovering disks, disgorging cargo. Lanier turned full circle, surveying the mountains and sea beyond the white-paved gate reception area. He had never seen a sky so intensely blue. Like a blowtorch describing an arc in the sky, a meteor plummeted toward the distant sea's surface. Before it struck, a web of pulsed orange rays lanced out from the horizon and shattered the meteor. More beams sought out and destroyed the crazily weaving fragments. Only dust remained to hit the ocean or land. That's the story of their life in a nutshell, Ram Kikura said, pointing to where the meteor had met its end. That's why the Frants are Frants. She took Lanier's hand and then reached for Patricia. Olmi gathered the other three around them. Come, we'll disembark soon. It's a bit heavier here. You'll need belts at first. The disk came to its assigned landing area. The transparent fields beneath them rearranged as they approached the white pavement, and the webwork of bright lines reformed into a vortex. The President's advocate and the director of the Nexus will go down first, Ram Kikura said. We follow, and then the France, and then the rest. Allegand Toller, Hulain Ram Seja, and their aides, two fish-shaped neomorphs and three homomorphs, drifted toward the center of the vortex and were smoothly deposited on the pavement beneath the disk. Olmi urged his group down, and they tracked it along the same path, feet touching ground a few meters from the President's party. After months in Thistledown and the Way, Timbal's pull was something of a shock, like suddenly being saddled with heavy bricks. Patricia's knees sagged, and her leg muscles protested. Heinemann groaned, and Carolson's face looked strained. Bus-sized, square, low-slung vehicles rolled up on large white wheels. As each person entered, France wrapped lift belts around them to lessen the effect of the heavier gravitation. Neomorphs, practically helpless without traction fields, were given special full-float belts that could be adjusted to fit their wide range of shapes. You should enjoy this, Ram Kikura told them, as the bus rolled off the white pavement onto a broad, brick-colored road. We're going to the beach. The Frant world, she explained, served as a resort for humans and several other oxygen-breathing beings in the Way. Because the level of ultraviolet from the bright yellow dwarf star was higher than humans were used to, an atmospheric shield had been erected over several thousand square kilometers. The resort lay in the shield's shadow. The ocean has few large carnivorous life forms, none that would want to eat humans anyway, and the environment is clean. It's ideal. The vacation spot of choice for all who can afford to go, which is virtually any corporeal citizen. The resort's long, low main building was in an ideal location, fronting a broad white quartz sand beach on one side of a half-moon harbor. Each room had a patio and transparent doors with a choice of undisguised real scenery or various illusart displays. The furniture, in keeping with the old terrestrial motif of the resort, was real and unchangeable. They ate lunch, their first meal on the Frant world, in a restaurant decorated in late 20th century style, the food served by homomorphs. Mechanical workers were not in evidence. After lunch, they walked to the resort buildings, and Ram Kikura inspected their rooms carefully before letting them enter. They still wore their belts, though Lanier felt he was up to doing without. He would only remove his when Heinemann did, however, and Heinemann seemed content to leave it on. Patricia looked around her room, then joined the others on Lanier's patio. Ram Kikura told them they could rest and swim for a few hours, and that she and Olmi would be nearby if they were needed. They're taking a room for themselves upstairs, Carolson said in a confidential tone after she had left. I think they're lovers. Patricia opened the patio's metal gate.
I'm going to take a walk, she said. She glanced at Lanier. Unless you think we should stick together all the time.
No, we're probably safe enough here. Go ahead. Lanier watched her walk down the beach, stiff-legging through the sand past homomorphs and even a few belted neomorphs. Nobody paid her much attention. He shook his head, smiling. Could be Acapulco, he said, with a few odd balloons drifting around. Farley put her arm around him.
I've never been to Acapulco, but I don't think it had a sky that color.
Lovebirds, Carrollson sniffed, glanced reproachfully at Heinemann. You never treat me that way. I'm an engineer, Heinemann said. I don't pamper. I just make things run right.
You do indeed, Carrollson said.
My God, listen to us. We're cheerful, Lanier said.
Patricia isn't, Carrollson said. I've seen her putting on her stern look when she sees you two. I think she's jealous, Gary.
Christ. Lanier sat down in a patio chair and stared across the dazzling beach and intense green-blue sea to the knife-sharp horizon. She's been an enigma since I first met her.
Not to me,
Farley said. All faces turned to her.
I understand her at least a little, she continued. I was like her. Less brilliant, but inner-directed, stubborn. My life was miserable until I was 25 or 26, and I decided to be more normal. Exterior normal, anyway.
She'll be 24 tomorrow, Carrollson said.
That's her birthday, Farley asked.
Carrollson nodded. I've told Olme and explained about birthday parties. He thinks it's a good idea. Apparently, they don't have birthdays here, so few people are actually born, biologically speaking. There are naming days, maturity celebrations, mostly in Axis Nader. I gather that age doesn't mean as much to them as it does to us.
So what kind of party will it be?
I suggested we keep it small. Ourselves, Olmi, Ram Kikura. He agreed. Lenore, you're a marvel, Lanier said, unconsciously adopting Hoffman's tone of voice. Carrollson curtsied and dimpled her cheeks with her twisting index fingers. We're more than cheerful, Heinemann said, staring at her. We're absolutely nuts. Patricia had gone about half a kilometer down the beach when she saw Ollaghan Toller standing on the sand ahead of her. He wore shorts, revealing blonde-haired, well-shaped legs, slightly bowed, and a loud Hawaiian print shirt. Do you like it? He asked, modeling for her. She gawped, not knowing what to say. End of side 9.